What is up, everyone? Welcome back to the Fitness Stuff for Normal People podcast. I'm Mariana.
And I'm Tony.
And the fitness industry right now kind of sucks. It's not the best. It's become something driven by whatever can really drive page views and clicks at this point, directing attention away from what actually matters. The bottom line is we're not trying to provide just another fitness podcast, but completely change the fitness industry for the better by giving you the knowledge and tools so you have confidence in applying the best possible training and nutrition into your own lives. Where today's episode, this is kind of close to home for me. I'm really excited to talk about it. I think it's really important. We're going to be talking about how to improve your relationship with food, because this is something that can absolutely make or break your success in achieving really any goal you have in terms of your health and fitness journey. And we're going to be giving you 5 evidence-based tips for making your overall eating experience just a more positive one moving forward, making navigating the crazy world of nutrition a little less daunting. So before we get into that, as always, the easiest way you can support us is by giving us a 5-star review on whatever platform you're listening. You can also give us a follow on Spotify so that you stay up to date on every new episode we drop on Mondays.
And if you want more after each episode, join us over on Premium for just $5 a month, where you get access to all of our complete 12-week training programs, a bonus episode every single Friday where we're answering your questions, and other sick perks like exclusive discounts to higher-end companies that we believe in, like Oura Ring, Merrick Health for blood work and labs, and so much more. The sign-up for that is in the show notes down below. And before we jump in, we want to thank Legion Athletics for being the sponsor of today's episode. I actually was just telling you before we got on here, I got my labs back recently, and my vitamin D was low.
Isn't that crazy? Like, you're taking supplements too, right?
Well, so I haven't been taking the vitamin D supplement in a while, but I live in San Diego, one of the sunniest cities, I'm pretty sure, on planet Earth. Like, it's sunny 350 days a year.
Except for when I go to visit.
Except when Mariana comes out to visit. And the optimal range you usually want to be in blood work is like between 70 and 100 for vitamin D. Mine came back at 37. So I just stocked up on their vitamin D and K again, I think about 3 months in a row, since I forgot to be taking it this last couple months. But vitamin D, if you haven't heard about us talk about it, we did that episode. It was episode 57 on vitamin D and how important it is for hormone production, for hormones like testosterone and estrogen, for your energy and fatigue through the day, and so much more than just bone health, which is what people think of it as. So if you want to stock up on your vitamin D, your magnesium, some grass-fed whey, or any of your staples, you can use the Legion link in the show notes below or type in code FSPOD, that's F-S-P-O-D, at checkout for 20% off your first order or double points on every order after that. When I get my vitamin D up, it's all over for you.
No, but it's crazy how that, like, you stop taking those supplements and for a lot of people, like, you notice it. And it's just... that's why I say really anyone can benefit from, no matter where you are living, no matter how much sun you get, really cannot hurt to take a vitamin D supplement.
Yeah. That was an episode a long time ago too, the 53. We covered it because it was in one of the top 5 vitamin and mineral nutrient deficiencies that people see. So many people deficient in it. It blows my mind.
Yeah.
But today's episode, even though it's a close place for home with you, I'm actually kind of excited for. Because this is a weird realization a lot of people have as they get deeper and deeper into fitness or whatever goal they're working towards, is that we learn a lot of stuff by the time we're adults, but most of it isn't inherent to us. Like, it's not inherent to learn how to swim. If you don't go through learning how to swim at some point in your life, you'll just be an adult who doesn't know how to swim. It doesn't just come with age. And your relationship with food, if you have ever got to go through body composition changes or health changes or something that causes you to pay more attention to your nutrition, it's a skill that a lot of people don't realize they never learned growing up in their life, even in their adult life. It just seems like one of those things that should be inherent, should be there, and it's not. And it's weird because it's also tied in with our biology of, like, oh, our bodies physically need this. This isn't a skill like playing the piano. This is something where it's like your biology is driving forces, society's kind of driving forces at it. And no one ever really learned how to navigate it. And you can see a real messed up view of food in some people. I've been there. I know you've been there down the road because you ignore the part and you just think this should come naturally. And it doesn't.
Yeah. And your food choices are not inherently yours growing up. It's not an autonomous decision that you make. Your parents typically will make those decisions. Your environment will make those decisions. Your access to food will make those decisions. Your culture will make those decisions. It's something that you don't learn on your own. So you're a product of your upbringing for the most part. And so when you're an adult and then all of a sudden you have control over your food decisions and you're thinking about them and you start to think about making decisions for your health, your well-being, or just being more cognizant of them, it's almost like you have to learn a behavior that is completely foreign and new to you and undo a lot of things that might be habitual. You may realize, oh shit, like how I've been approaching this is not any, it's not healthy. This is not just physically, but mentally, or how I view food, this may not be the best approach. So it can be really hard to navigate. And I also think something that is very interesting is from personal experience as someone who grew up in a family with my parents were so good about fostering a good, healthy relationship with food. And I am so fortunate for that. But I still fell into an eating disorder. I honestly can say, especially after learning so much about nutrition, looking back on how my parents viewed food and had it around us, it is like one of the best examples I could think of. And I still had the worst relationship with food. So a lot of it being like, sometimes you just don't, you can't even control how you fell into it. You know what I mean? So I think that that's really interesting as well.
Yeah, but not even just learning new behaviors, but unlearning old behaviors, which honestly, a lot of the time, unlearning behaviors that you've had your whole life, so like unconscious behaviors, are harder to unlearn than it is to learn a new behavior.
Yeah.
I would say almost every single time that's the truth. Mm-hmm. That's the truth.
Yeah. So let me crack open my Diet Coke.
There we go. Get that aspartame. Get that brain pumping.
Yeah, get the artificial sweeteners. But I feel like it's a good starting point is just kind of thinking about and discussing like what is your current relationship with food like? That's the first starting point of thinking, okay, do I have some work to do? Which I think your relationship with food exists on a spectrum and it's not fixed. Sometimes you might be doing better than others, or sometimes you might have more to work on. But you can always, there's always aspects of your relationship with food that I think people can work on. And I don't like to classify things as good or bad, but in this situation, there are signs of having a not the best relationship with food, and there are signs of having a good relationship with food. So even though Tony and I don't usually like to make that contrast when we're talking about diet,
and we aren't going to either, but we aren't going to label things as good or bad. Like doing something is either good or bad, because we've gone through your intention behind what you're doing can be good or bad. Like for myself, like slamming a whole entire pepperoni pizza on a Friday night after I had the longest week of my life because I want to celebrate and enjoy myself, that can be good with my relationship with food, where for someone else that can be a really bad sign. Exactly. So good and bad is super context dependent, I think, when it comes to food.
Yeah. So pinpointing signs and symptoms of a bad relationship with food can be helpful, but your overall relationship with food doesn't have anything to do with the quality of your diet or the type of food you eat. It's how and why you choose those foods. So that can lead to, you know, looking at different types of foods that you're choosing, but the whole preface like behind it is that motivation for choosing foods. And I think that that can help clarify this a little bit more and show how different it can be for other people. So just some signs of a poor relationship with food. And again, you might not have all these, you might have some, and some might be more extreme than others, but it's just feeling guilty about eating and feeling guilty about eating regularly. Avoiding or restricting foods that you think are bad for you. So even if you want them, even if you want these foods, you're craving them, not allowing yourself to have foods. And that sometimes, if you are trying to lose weight and there are certain foods that you know what, I might overeat these a little bit, there are other decisions I can make. There are healthy ways to approach that. So again, I just want to make that clear that some people might be able to do these things and the intention behind it may be fine. Some other signs may be having a really long list of food rules that these are all the things I cannot do, really focusing on what I cannot do around food. This adds to a lot of stress, a lot of rumination. ignoring your body's natural hunger cues is a big one. Constantly going on and off of diets, so that yo-yo dieting habit, finding yourself in this restrict binge cycle. And another thing is food never leaving your mind. You're constantly thinking about it. It takes up a lot of brain space.
And like you just said too, like just for anyone listening to this, if you said I do one or two of these things, doesn't automatically mean you have a poor relationship with food. And a lot of them, like you mentioned, the context really depends. And I know we were talking about it beforehand, where if you're dieting for a physique show or a bodybuilding show or anything close to prep, or even honestly just some bigger body composition changes, not even for professional reasons, there's going to be some of these that you can put in and implement into your own plan in a healthy way, like avoiding certain foods or having to cut off and having to restrict yourself and ignoring your body's, it's not even ignoring your body's hunger cues that we're talking about later, but when you're in a dieting phase, you're going to experience some hunger most of the time.
Yeah.
So it's how you approach that in a sense of maybe paying attention to it, noting that it is there, but then choosing to go past that because it is more in accordance to your goals. That's not necessarily unhealthy by itself. It can be unhealthy when you're completely ignoring this, or you're shoving these feelings down, or like you're starving, you're physically hungry, like your stomach's rumbling.
It's constant.
And like you're shoving it down. That can be a negative relationship. So this is all going to be explored a little bit more later, but just to even point out even there, if you're like, oh crap, I do one or two of those things, that's not necessarily a bad thing automatically.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a good gauge too is if you feel any type of shame or guilt or stress or fear regarding the foods you eat, that in and of itself is a sign that your relationship needs work. It may not be bad, but it may need work. Sometimes you may eat and feel completely fine about it. You have no remorse about the foods that you're eating, but other times you may feel really guilty about eating certain foods. Like that's normal. The goal is not perfection, but to have more positive experiences with food than negative ones. Just to be realistic here, right? It could be things like listening and honoring your body's natural hunger cues. This includes knowing how to stop eating when you're starting to feel full. So not getting to those extremes of the hunger and fullness spectrum. No foods are off limits, so to say, but you understand which foods you might want to eat in moderation. Choosing foods that make you feel your best and align with your goals, but it's not a make or break. Oh my God, I had an Oreo and it's the end of the world because that's going to ruin all of my progress, things like that. Guilt and shame are not driving your eating behaviors. You're able to actually enjoy your foods, not approaching eating for the sole reason of only sticking to a calorie goal. So that's something, right, where you can have that balance of I have to be in a calorie deficit, but that forever is not going to be my sole driver, looking at the number of calories in a food as being the only reason I'm eating. So I'm trying to clarify these extremes to give you an idea of that. And also the opinions of others. I think this is a big one. The opinions of others not dictating your food choices. We're going to talk about that one a little bit more because how often are we influenced by other people, especially on the internet, telling us what we should and shouldn't eat, acting like they know our bodies best and not driving our decisions. That can really mess with your head because how many opinions are out there? Like, they don't know you. So
If you listen to everyone's opinion, you have an empty plate. You've got nothing left.
Yeah. And this can be so overwhelming. No single person has a perfect relationship with food. So instead of focusing on checking off every sign that, I have a good relationship with food, approach one at a time. Approach one that you think takes up the most headspace, that you can really relate to the most and be like, I wish that I knew how to stop eating when I was full. Oh my goodness. I wish I can honor my hunger cues. That would make my life so much better. Focus on that one, right? Like this shouldn't like bring about stress. It should give you relief that there's things you can do about it.
Which before we get into the five tips we're going to go through today, I feel like there's this interesting idea that just popped up when you said everything's about how many calories a food has. Is this kind of interesting thing where, I mean, you've heard the phrase, food is fuel. And a lot of people live and die by it. But I was thinking about this a little bit earlier, and it's so interesting because on a biological level, that's true. That's all food is fuel. You put compounds that contain energy into your body. It goes through your digestive system. That takes the energy out of the food so your body can use it as energy, as literal fuel. That's what it is on a biological level. And I know that I see people all the time getting into fitness when they realize this, and it's exciting and empowering at first. This idea that food is fuel and thinking about it like that, because you start to notice, oh my God, you feel way better. You perform in the gym way better. And you see your body change quicker than you ever had before when you start eating more and more quality food. And you're like, wow, I'm really fueling my body. But where I see that take a negative turn is when you start to only see food as fuel. And you start to treat it like that's all it's really good for. And this can go deeper and deeper. Because we've gone over this 100 times. Tracking your calories and macros, at least in, I think, my opinion, I think you'd agree with me, is one of the most important skills you can take yourself through for several months to learn more about food.
Yeah.
And just body composition change, how your body runs from a fuel perspective. So important. But if you go so deep into that level, that's all food turns into is just fuel. Calories and macros, your proteins, your carbs, your fats, and you get no more enjoyment out of it. And it can really screw people up long term when they're trying to fix their relationship with food because they're treating it like it's one thing. Mm. And it's like, yeah, it is fuel, but it's also a form of celebration, like something you can feel great about. Like one of my favorite ways to celebrate major milestones is to go out for, and honestly, overspend a little bit on an incredible meal.
Yeah.
FYI, I just did this last weekend to Seneca in San Diego. If you come out to San Diego again, we're going to Seneca. Incredible.
Okay.
But to celebrate things, to get something good, it's a part of your cultural identity a lot of the times.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I'm freaking Italian. And there's just certain meals that making homemade spaghetti, homemade meatballs, rolling it out all day makes me feel more connected to my family, to my roots. It gives you a sense of little, and this sounds stupid and cheesy, but it's true.
It's
social
so
connection.
True.
It's a form of art even.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's like a lot about your health, but it's so much more than just fuel, period.
Yeah.
So much more than that. So if you treat it like that, you're not going to get anywhere improving your relationship with it.
Mm-mm. Oh my gosh. I remember there's a point, I think about this all the time, where I really thought like all I wanted was to not think about food all the time. Just, I would sit in my kitchen and just cry, like genuinely cry, because again, this is an extreme. Like I had anorexia. Okay. But I would cry because all I thought about was food. All I fucking thought about was food and being hungry. And it was the worst experience. And I genuinely believed that that was going to be the rest of my life. And I have actually seen recently on TikTok videos of a lot of girls posting, oh, just like thinking about the time when I used to not think about food 24/7. My life was so much better before I thought about food 24/7. And it's possible to change that. So if you are in that cycle of just like, oh my God, food consuming every single thought and bringing about so much stress, like it is absolutely possible for that to change. I don't know. I just have to bring that up because I feel like, oh,
That's a huge sign though, because you see so many people where if you go real deep into and you're stuck in this dieting wheel over and over again, you think about food 24/7. I know towards the end of my cutting phases, even though I wouldn't say it was like an unhealthy way at all, you get to the point where you're just freaking hungry and you finish breakfast and 20 minutes later, then the only thing you can start to think about, no matter how distracted you are with work or anything, is dang, I can't wait for lunch. When is lunch going to be? Oh, I was going to eat at 11:30. I think I could probably eat at 11, and you start reasoning. And then same thing after lunch, you eat and you're like, okay, I got 4 hours till dinner. Here's how I can block. That's 4 1-hour periods. That's 16, 15 minute blocks. Like you start thinking about it, it consumes everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think a lot of people don't realize that that's not a good thing.
They just realize this is exhausting
after a while. You're like, holy crap, when can I stop thinking about this?
Yeah. Like the fact that I have moments, honestly, like every week where I will sit down and appreciate, holy shit, I'm doing something and I'm not hungry. That's crazy to me. Like, you know, and I'm just so appreciative of it because I thought that would never happen. But going through some tips of how to get you there, because it's not easy. It's not some like overnight change, but how to improve your relationship with food. I think one of the biggest hurdle for a lot of people is really paying attention to and honoring your hunger and fullness cues. That is, because again, that it's that hunger piece. Tony was just giving the perfect example of it. It just can seep into every aspect of your life, feeling hungry all the time. There are so many things that drive us to eat and not eat. People eat because of the time of day. They eat because they're anxious, happy, sad, bored. They're too polite to say no. Everyone else is eating. someone brought cookies to work and you smell them and now you want them even though you're not actually hungry. Or your family cooked for you and it's really disrespectful to say no even though you're not hungry. People choose not to eat because they're busy, they're sad, they're mad, they're guilty, they're ashamed. Nobody else is eating, or it's too early or too late to eat. They don't like the way they look, so they're not going to eat.
There's so many internal and external. I know a lot of people when hearing this for the first time, I mean, I wasn't even familiar with the term hunger cues until the last couple of years in using it for coaching, because these cues tell you things, like treating it like data almost, on how you can navigate moving forward to make this better. This isn't just paying attention to small things, but these cues, if you learn how to use them right, this is why this is number one on the list, the most important, is because if you learn how to use them, you can change your behavior moving forward. It's like stepping on the scale every day when you're going through a fat loss phase. If you keep weighing the same weight, that's just data telling you, hey, you're not in a calorie deficit. Or if you're gaining weight, hey, you're in a calorie surplus. Same thing with hunger cues. This can tell you where there might be areas to improve on. And this is one thing I didn't even realize until you kind of broke up or started this off, is there's internal and external cues, it seems like. Right? Like internal being like, okay, my stomach's growling. I have some cravings right now. Maybe I'm a little fatigued or lightheaded. Some internal cues. But then there's a lot of external cues that seem to play a factor. Like you were saying, the time of day, scents and smells, which we know change your biology. Even just marketing. There's been some really interesting studies just showing people images of very appetizing looking food and it changing. Mm-hmm. They start to salivate a little bit. Their body starts to change. So there's like a big difference. Is there a big difference between the two? I'm assuming there would be.
Oh, for sure. And listening to our internal cues, our cues coming from our body, really getting to the habit of making that what you do most of the time. Because again, we can't get rid of all of these external cues. Sometimes, right, we're going to be with our family and they are going to be cooking for us and they are going to be offering things to us. And that's not going to happen every day. But the majority of the time, allowing yourself to have those internal cues from your physiology, your body, being the main driver, that is going to be your best course of action. But it's hard. It doesn't mean that it's easy. But if you start to lean into that more, understanding what it actually feels like to be hungry, what it actually feels like to be full, will make it easier to override these external cues versus leaning into things that you have been habituated over time to do. Is it really impolite to turn down a piece of cake at a work party? No, but you've been taught that. So when you're listening to those internal cues of, no, I'm actually not hungry, I'm all set, having that be the driver, it has this ripple effect.
That's where I get, because I'm a type 1 diabetic, right? That's one of my favorite excuses for people trying to peer pressure with me with food, is because most people don't understand what type 1 diabetes is, where I could pretty much eat whatever I want to. If I wanted to down a whole pizza, I could down a whole pizza. Nonchalant. But people think diabetes has something big to do with food. So if someone's like, oh, come on, have a slice of cake, I'm like, oh, I'm diabetic, I can't. They're like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Like, I just say it to get people off my back. Even though I could totally eat the piece of cake, it cracks me up because that's one of my favorite excuses.
Yeah.
It's crazy to think, though, the marketing and the advertising and how you're we're going to go over this topic of what mindful eating is later, which I think is so interesting because it really is just recognizing those cues. And you don't realize how many things are influencing your drive to eat through the day.
Yeah.
Like those are real papers that look at scents and smells and just imagery and how your biology physically changes. My favorite example is of that milkshake study that we brought up forever ago, where your biology changes based on what you think you're eating, not on what you're actually eating, right? Your brain is determining how your biology, how your body is physically responding to the food going into it. There is a really interesting study done at Yale University that separated participants into two groups. And both groups were given the same exact milkshake with the same nutritional makeup. Everything was the same. It was a chocolate milkshake. The only difference between the groups was what they told each group they were getting. So group A, they were told that they were going to get a high calorie, high sugar milkshake that contained over 600 calories. Like this is a sweet treat dessert. Group B was told that they were getting a low calorie, healthier meal replacement shake. same exact shake, told them they were getting two different things. And what they were testing for was this hormone called ghrelin. Ghrelin's the hunger hormone. It tells us when we're hungry or to eat more food. Now, the group that thought they were getting a high calorie, high sugar milkshake, so that group A, when you look at their blood levels from before to during to after the milkshake, actually consuming it, you saw a massive spike in ghrelin leading up to the milkshake, like a nearly double spike in ghrelin leading up to the milkshake. And then once they consumed it, they had an even bigger drop off to way below where they first started at in their ghrelin hormones, or telling them I'm super, super hungry the closer we get to it. And then afterwards being much more satisfied with the meal. But the group that thought they were getting the healthy meal replacement shake basically saw no changes start to finish in their ghrelin. So they didn't get this initial craving leading up to it, but they didn't feel satisfied, or that level of ghrelin didn't decrease after they had already consumed it. Mm-hmm. Okay, same exact milkshake. How the body actually changed and responded, completely different based on what they thought they were getting.
Yeah.
And that's not even just that. They were telling this and spelling this out for them. But think about what's ruling or dictating this for you. If you haven't spent years, over a decade in this field, like Marianne has been in for 10 years, and you don't have a real grasp on what nutrition of a food really looks like, what it means, have a good relationship with it now. What you already think about a food could be completely incorrect, but that's determining how you probably respond to it, how your body responds to it, just based on what you think about it.
Yeah.
So interesting to me.
My physiological response to certain food, and it is crazy how your brain can react to food based off of learned behaviors that aren't true, or things you've been fed that aren't true. Like when I would see bread, just having bread, I used to like would eat a pizza without the bread. I would just take it off. But if seeing it would make me, and this sounds crazy, again, I'm on the extreme, I'm talking about like eating disorder level, but my heart rate would skyrocket. I would start to sweat. I would start to get so, like, I would go into fight or flight mode if I ate that whole, like, holy shit. That's why in so many inpatient eating disorder clinics, one, they'll give you yogurt. You know it's yogurt, but you would never know if it's non-fat versus full fat. You're never going to see a label. You're never going to read it because it elicits this response. And even if you know you're in inpatient, so you know they're giving you food, you know you're having more calories, just that simple difference of not knowing whether or not you're having full fat versus fat free has more of a calming effect on eating disorder patients and will allow them to eat more because they're not in that fight or flight mode, even though it's still anxious in the back of their head. But that little difference has a huge effect, which is crazy.
It's insane to think about. That's insane.
Yeah. Yeah. So there is really, first of all, ask yourself, how many times this week did you actually eat when you were hungry and stop when you were full? In America, this is not a common behavior that a lot of people know how to do. So just ask yourself that first. And if you think like, oh, I have no idea how to do that, that's impossible for me to do. Every single person is born with the natural ability to regulate their hunger. You see this with children who can easily tell whether they're hungry or full. I'm an aunt now. I think this is so fascinating to look at how my niece, who is 1.5, communicates with us to tell she's done. She does hand motions. She knows.
Oh, that's cool.
Like, my sister doesn't have to tell her, hey, you're full, you're done. She knows how to tell you. It's just, it's instinct. And again, my sister's doing a really good job to honor that at such a young age and not forcing her more food because she thinks she needs it. But it is, as we age, you begin to lose this ability for a number of reasons, which is sad. Most of us learn to ignore this inner voice in an effort to clear our plates. Maybe you grew up in a clean plate club. You can't leave the table until your plate is clear. Or you grow up trying to limit eating even when you're hungry out of fear of gaining weight. Maybe your parents put you on Weight Watchers and you're still hungry, but it doesn't matter because you're not getting any more food. Maybe you grew up in a household where you didn't have much money. So even if you're still hungry, you don't have more food. So that is just, while sometimes parents' intentions may be good, the more autonomy you take away from kids as you grow up in terms of their eating decisions, the less you know how to have a good relationship with food, how to make choices that are actually coming from you and what your hunger and fullness needs are. Diet culture has also taught people to rely on an arbitrary number, right? They look at people as a whole as the same and needing the same amount of calories, the same amount of fat, carbs, protein, what have you, and telling you this is exactly how much you should or shouldn't be eating, or these are exactly, like, if you are eating past this time, even though you're still hungry, it doesn't matter, right? We are learning these behaviors that are taking us away from our natural hunger and fullness cues. So in order to help with this, if you are at a point where you're like, I don't really even know where to begin, like, I'm either like really hungry or really full, or I just don't pay attention to it at all. But think about hunger and fullness on a scale of 0 to 10. So 0 to 1 being famished, 9 to 10 being painfully stuffed. Like, oh my God, like Thanksgiving dinner and I'm still eating dessert, right? You want to begin eating or try to eat when you first start to notice your hunger. You're around a 3 or 4. You're not starving, but you're hungry. And stop eating when you get comfortably full. So you're not at a 9 or 10, like, oh my God, I'm going to burst, but a 6 or 7 where you're like, oh, I do know if I eat more, then I'm going to be way too full. And the scales are tough, right? They're not an exact for everyone. But unfortunately, like, there's not much around this. This is like one of the best practices to understand your hunger, but it is, scales are tough sometimes. But you just really don't want to go to the extreme on either side of the scale. You shouldn't wait until you're starving when people tend to make poor nutrition choices and you're more likely to have less control. You're more likely to overeat, right? Eating when you notice signs of hunger allows you to be more mindful when you eat. And that is going to be really helpful. Just even, and this is, we're going to talk about this with mindful eating, but even just starting to understand what a 0 or 2 on the scale looks like to you versus a 9 or 10, you're already making progress because you're starting to pay attention to your hunger and fullness versus just going with it. Actually sitting down and paying attention to it. What does this look like? What foods am I eating that actually make me feel satisfied and I don't overeat, versus what foods do I still feel like I'm starving after? So you're just starting to get a handle on it, paying attention to hunger and fullness, understanding what it looks like. That's going to be the biggest step. And it's a time thing, right? Putting more time and effort into it, it will become more habitual, easier to lean into those internal cues versus the external cues from our environment.
And the way I use this with clients and how I think it's really helpful to be using on yourself if you're just starting to use this is, and I know we even have this on Premium, we have a little Google check-in doc that you can copy and make for yourself to check it in. But just where at the end of each day or at the end of the week, just prompting yourself to answer a few questions. This doesn't have to be on your mind 24/7 every time you eat right off the bat. But at the end of the day, just asking yourself a few questions like, okay, what were the periods of today where I was feeling the most hungry? Or were there any periods where I was feeling like a 0 to 2, right? Where I was just starving? It's like after a week of noticing these things, or same thing on the other end of the spectrum, were there any periods where I felt like a 10, like I couldn't even move after I had eaten? You start to notice patterns where you start to see, oh, I'm really hitting that like 0 to 1 point at like 3, 4 in the afternoon where my stomach's starting to growl. I'm physically getting a little lightheaded. And that wasn't just today. That was most days this week. I'm hitting that point at 3 or 4. And every night I overeat out of my calorie deficit. I'm stuffing my face up and I'm not losing weight because I'm eating so much at night. That's when most overeating tends to happen. Mm-hmm. What that can then tell you to do is say, oh, maybe I should restructure some of my day and make my lunch a little bit larger or add some bigger protein meals into it.
Yeah.
And then you make those changes and you start to notice, oh, I added something to my lunch that was 20 extra grams of protein and a few extra 100 calories, which was a lot, but I didn't hit that hunger desert middle afternoon. I made it all the way to dinner without really thinking I needed food. And then I didn't overeat that night by hundreds of extra calories. Well, look at that. Like, you just completely changed your trajectory. And that's how paying attention to these cues can be super useful, is you start to recognize these holes in your day where you're experiencing a 10 or a 2 or a 1. Mm-hmm. And then you can change different aspects around that to make sure you're not hitting those and you are staying next to the middle. I think that's so, so helpful to learn how to do. Mm-hmm. So it's not in every meal you have to be doing this kind of thing, but even at the end of the day, on your notes app, even at the end of the week, just taking 5 minutes and really thinking about it.
Yeah. Because it just it highlights patterns in your eating behaviors that you could pick up on and be like, holy shit, like I had a really stressful week and I ate so much more food. Like even just, you know, or I had more free time and I was just bored. Like looking at your behaviors, and it gives you just an actual direction to make a specific targeted change. It's just more data so that you can be more informed on where you should make changes in your day. And when you mm-hmm. have good days, like pay attention to those. Like, wow, I went to bed and I wasn't hungry at all. I felt like I didn't overeat. I didn't have any drive to. I felt good. I didn't think about food much. Let's look at that. Let's look at those meals. Let's repeat that.
Yeah. So. One last example I'll give before moving into number two for the day that I've brought up several times on this podcast is what I used to do when I was going through a deficit or dieting phase is after some time of dieting, I would constantly recognize whenever I would fall off, it's because I would end up overeating at night from like 7 to 9 p.m. I would get to like a 9 or 10, not a 9 or 10, sorry, the other end, a 1 or a 2 on the hunger scale. I was physically hungry. I wasn't just having cravings. My stomach was growling. I was starving. And that was every single night. And sometimes I would train myself to just drink a big glass of water and go to bed hungry. And so, you know what? This is what fat loss takes. I get it. But over time, I started paying more and more attention to that and be like, why is this the hungriest period of my day?
Yeah.
Okay. When is the least hungry portion of my day? And I noticed by asking myself that question, well, you know what? Like I'm having my morning smoothie and acai bowl with, I think it was a good 600-700 calories in it. And I'm not really that hungry when I wake up. I'm just not. Those are my personal hunger cues. I wake up and I'm not that hungry. So I was like, okay, let me shift my day a little bit. This is where I implemented more of a like a hybrid fasting technique where I would just have a protein shake when I woke up, 120 calories, but a little bit of protein to break a fast. But I wouldn't have a massive breakfast. And what that would let me do is then if my calorie goal was, let's say 2,400, is increase the size of my lunch and the size of my dinner by several hundred calories each, 300-400 calories, and make those the bigger meals of my day centered around where I'm naturally just the most hungry.
Yeah.
And voila, what do you know? I wasn't hungry going to bed anymore.
Yeah,
I just played according to my natural hunger cues and it worked. I wasn't miserable. I wasn't having to force myself drink multiple glasses of water so I could just stop thinking about hunger for a 30-minute window to trick myself into falling asleep.
Yeah.
You can really have some fun playing with yourself like this. Mm-hmm. So let's go into number two. And I'm about to smack you with this one. This is a stern rule. This is a stern rule for Mariana and I. And that is stop labeling foods as good or bad. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it, stop it. Like we just talked about this in that last one of how your biology responds to how you see something. If you tell yourself that a food is bad, like that milkshake, the group that got the high sugary, the treat, the kind of off limits milkshake that was not good for them, they saw this massive spike in ghrelin or this craving for hunger. I'm hungry now before they got that shake because they thought it was worse for them. If you're telling yourself that X, Y, or Z, whatever food is quote unquote bad for you, all you're going to do is want that more. 99% of the time, those people are going to want that more. And we've talked about this on so many other episodes because you still might be saying, well, yeah, but what about the truly bad foods? What about the seed oils? What about the artificial sweet? What about, no, one food cannot be healthy or unhealthy. A diet as a whole can be healthy or unhealthy, but not a single food. You can look at this over and over again in Mark Hobbs' self-study that he went through with the gas station diet of losing weight. You can look at Jordan Syed, who ate a Big Mac every single day, lost 7 pounds, and all blood markers improved. You can include any single food in your diet and still improve and see remarkable health markers. Remarkable. Because your health is so much more than just a single food. I mean, your diet as a whole, just the quality of food, only makes up around 20% of your internal health and your activity and your muscle mass and your body composition and your genetics. So many things go into your health that not even just your diet makes up a small piece. One single food choice is so insignificant, it doesn't even matter. It cannot matter because it's so small of a piece of the puzzle. So the more you're telling yourself this is good or bad, whatever it is, the more you're making this harder on yourself for no apparent reason. Mm-hmm. And I will die on that grave because people will go on arguing the seed oils, even though that's a ridiculous conversation that's based on rodent studies only, never a human trial, with all human evidence showing the opposite effect in most cases. But whatever food someone's telling you to avoid, if it's eating raw milk instead of regular, whatever, there's no basis to it. There's no basis to it. The poison's always in the dose. If you are only eating Big Macs, probably not going to be great on your health. If you have one Big Mac every once in a while because you love it, I promise you, if everything else is in line, you're not going to notice.
It's me with my Diet Coke, right? I always tell people, this is such a small one can of Diet Coke, okay? 12 fluid ounces out of my whole, let's say I maybe have a Diet Coke like every other day, but let's even say I had one a day. Because people say, you know, these cause cancer, or is that the biggest one? Is that like the aspartame causes cancer or whatever, right?
Sure. And then I posted on my story the other day, people are now saying it causes autism. I got a lot of DMs about that.
Yeah. Looking at this in relation to my diet as a whole, my whole entire diet, what I'm eating every single day throughout the week, and also you have to include the big rocks that influence health, also have to look at it, including my sleep health, my stress levels, my activity levels throughout the day. So let's look at that too. Mm-hmm. How much of an impact this tiny amount of Diet Coke I'm having on my health in that large scheme of things is so minuscule, you couldn't even measure it.
It's a grain of sand.
I'm not drinking 35 Cokes, Diet Cokes every single day. It has zero power. This one Diet Coke has zero power over those huge pieces of my overall diet and my lifestyle and activity habits.
It's a grain of sand on a beach.
Yeah.
It is so, so small. Because when you look at what really determines a healthy diet, and we've talked about this before, and it's people are always so shocked when we say this. It's not about eliminating any certain food. For example, the seed oil conversation or high saturated fat or whatever you want to do, sugar, anything. The shocking part is that when most people find out and they actually look at the data, is any of those individual foods, even sugar, high processed foods, whatever you want to name it, no matter how bad you think it is, it's not causing the problem. The problem is coming from the absence of what matters in your diet if that's making up too much of it.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when you look at like the biggest thing that I think is important as far as the quality of a diet and your overall health, is hitting the RDA for vitamins and minerals is a big piece of it. Look at your top five vitamin and mineral deficiency episode. I think that was in the last 20 or 30. Go scroll back if you need. I forget the number. But if you're low on vitamin D, magnesium, calcium, potassium, iron, those are the big five. If you're getting enough of those and everything else in your diet, your body is going to maintain and respond extremely healthy if you have a Twix bar on top of it, because all of its needs are getting met. Where these things that people label as unhealthy or bad start to become a problem is if you're filling up your entire diet with, like this is a common example, protein shakes. Protein shakes are a great source of protein to add on to help you get to your goal. So people are like, okay, if it's digested the same as regular food, why can't I just replace regular food with protein shakes? Well, you're going to start to notice a lot of problems, but the problems won't come from that protein shake. It's going to come from not getting the vitamins, the minerals, the fiber, all the things that food comes with that you're not getting with the shake. Yeah. So it's not that the shake is harmful. It's not that sugar is harmful. And I know that's one that people are like, oh, are you sure about that? Yes. Look at all the human data on this. If your calories are controlled, your weight, your composition, your activity is controlled, sugar seems to have almost zero impact on your overall health and can be beneficial at times. So even with sugar or anything else, if it starts to make up too much of your diet where you're not getting the things you need, you're not getting your fiber, you're not getting any of these vitamins or minerals, that's where the problems come from, are from what you're not getting, not from what you are getting.
Yeah.
So just logically, it doesn't make sense to label foods as good as bad.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the problem with the standard American diet, right? It is that leads to poor health outcomes. The overconsumption of ultra processed foods high in saturated fats, high in sugar, high in calories out of a package, and the accompanied by the underconsumption of nutritious food, healthful foods high in omega-3 fatty acids, high in fiber, high in protein, high in whole grains, right? High in micronutrients. You have to include both in the definition of the standard American diet. People shit on that diet all the time, which, yes, the standard American diet is not good for you, but they only focus on the fact that it is high in ultra-processed foods. They exclude the other half of the definition of the standard American diet, accompanied by the underconsumption of these health-promoting foods. They just completely leave that out, right? And that is such an important piece of it that you really need to think about. That's why we talk about these dietary patterns. So it's just, you are wasting so much stress if you are thinking about food on the scale of individual foods, because they don't make up your whole diet. And if they do, then maybe look at it.
It just breeds an unhealthy relationship with food over time, because it's, yeah, one, logically or scientifically, there's no data to support that foods can be good or bad on their own. None of it. So anything you are labeling it as is only because you're covering something else up, I guess, internally. It doesn't end well over time. It makes any progress you're trying to make with your hunger cues, with anything else, it makes it harder. Because sometimes you might think or see that foods that you typically label as bad or unhealthy could be very beneficial in certain settings. Mm-hmm. Like for that pizza example I gave at the very beginning, I think most people would typically label pizza as a bad thing. But let's say you're being super, I don't want to say strict, but very determined on your diet. And you're sticking to your calories and you're nailing your macros and you're going to bed every night and you're doing the hard things. On Fridays, having a slice of pizza to kind of celebrate, to give you that taste of a little overconsumption, things like that, can be one of the best things mentally, because you're like, okay, I can celebrate. I can have this. It's good for my soul a little bit. It keeps you going. Yeah. You can keep doing that for week after week after week. And that's where you notice people who try and cut out all foods that they determine as bad, their diets never last longer than 30 days, because they end up binging or going back because it's not sustainable. Cool. I don't care if you can do something for a month. Show me that you can do it for a year and I'll be impressed.
One of my favorite nutrition behaviors, practices, tips that I give with clients and people in general who really struggle with binging on their favorite foods or having certain foods that they restrict all the time or fear is, say, for example, Oreos. I don't know why I always give that as an example, but say Oreos is the food that you just like. Mm-hmm. Believe you can never have, or it's so bad, or it's going to make you gain weight, or you always overeat them, I will challenge them to include 2 Oreos with your lunch every single day of your workday. Mm-hmm. Bring 2 Oreos to work with you. I don't care. This can include if you're trying to lose weight, gain weight, if you don't have any weight-related goals, doesn't matter. This is going to, one, repeatedly expose you to a food that you have attached this fear and anxiety and stress. You have this learned behavior attached to a food, and a learned irrational behavior. So we're trying to undo that with exposure to it in moderation. So you're repeatedly eating this food in a healthy way because you're having it with your lunch. So it's a part of your lunch. It's not something that, oh my God, I'm stuffed and I still want to eat the Oreos. No, it's a part of it. So I'm not overeating them. It is satisfying a craving, or maybe you don't have it. They're just a part of it. So it's like, oh, this is my sweet part of my lunch. You know, you can always have them. They are always there over time, depending on where this person is at with their relationship with food. It may just be like 2 or 3 weeks, but over time, maybe you just don't even want those Oreos. You have all of a sudden you have a sleeve of Oreos in your pantry and they went bad because you forgot they were there, because they are always available. And this is one of the best things I will recommend to anyone, because you prove to yourself, one, especially if you have a weight related goal, a lot of the time the fear is with these foods that you may look at as off limits or bad. The fear a lot of the time is gaining weight from them or losing control around them.
Yeah.
So we're trying to prove to ourselves that fear is not going to happen if we allow them just to be a normal part of our diet. They're not going to be a huge part of it, but we could just look at them as a normal food that is just going to bring me satisfaction and joy. And I like the taste of it, right? It's not going to add any nutritional value, but my behavior around this food is now normal. I'm not thinking about Oreos all the time. Maybe it's ice cream. I'm not thinking about them.
Yeah.
So that can be really helpful. And then it's just kind of like, we're not viewing foods in a hierarchy. It's looking at foods in terms of the purpose they serve for you in the moment or at the time period you're at, and whether or not these food choices align with your nutrition and health goals. So food should serve as both nourishment and enjoyment. How often that is just going to depend on the point you're in your life, your overall health, what you need to lean more into. But aiming to limit them in like an all or nothing phenomenon is not going to allow you to make these choices that truly align with what you're trying to achieve, because then you're just guided by a label or what other people are saying or learned behaviors that aren't true. So it's just allowing you to make these more autonomous decisions that.
That's so important, because you're right. It's so funny. The people who always say, no, I couldn't just do two Oreos, or I couldn't just have a bowl of ice cream or whatever without destroying the whole pack or whatever. It's like, have you ever tried just doing that every day? It's like, no, I haven't done it in a week. And I feel like if I do too, I'm going to overeat or binge or whatever. It's like, just try it. It almost always works out.
Yeah.
What's number three?
Number three. So this is eating mindfully and like really just listening to your body's needs. So mindful eating is so misunderstood and gets a really bad reputation. But I think this is for good reason, because it's not explained properly.
Not at all.
A lot of people look at mindful eating as like almost this like, I don't know.
I used to look at it like very woo-woo, very okay, whatever.
Yeah,
it's like, for people who don't want to track their food. It's for people who don't do this.
Yeah.
It's terribly explained. I hardly see anybody explain it well.
Like, it's not just, listen to whatever your body is telling you, eat whatever you want. Like that, you know what I mean?
Or, that's it's what just, it's explained
as. Oh, it pisses me off. But it involves eating in the moment and being present for your eating experiences. So eating free of other distractions, taking time to make observations like how your food tastes, the texture of your food, your hunger and fullness cues, how they're changing, how they are going into a meal, how much you're enjoying it, right? Slowing down and savoring the food you're eating. This helps you learn which foods you genuinely enjoy. It helps become more in tune with your body's natural hunger and fullness cues. And also, it allows you to identify the reasons you're making your food choices. That's like the biggest thing about mindful eating, is it really allows you to take a step back and think about, why am I eating the foods that I'm eating? Is this serving my overall like goals? Is this in line with what I genuinely want? Are you eating because you're starving and will eat anything in sight? Or do you want to eat foods because you think they'll make you feel better emotionally or physically? So it's really just about being present, understanding why you're eating the foods you're eating, and being there, being in the moment with your food, which this is so like, I feel like people are like, okay, what do you like? Yeah, like I am there. I am eating. In American society, we are always constantly on the go, rushing, like trying to get to and from so fast, eating your breakfast while you're walking or on the train, or just scarfing down lunch so that you can get on to the next thing. Always just like not stopping. And so this is like a very real problem, and it can be very impactful for a lot of people. So tips for eating more mindfully is just one, like eating slowly, not rushing your meals. I get guilty of that sometimes when I get to a point of being so hungry. That's why it's kind of like, want to make sure we're not too hungry first, because it makes it more difficult.
Yeah.
But I still have to remind myself, like, chew your food, like actually chew your food thoroughly and then swallow it versus just like inhaling
it. I do too.
Another thing is going to be eliminating distractions. So, for example, right, like eating, if this is one that it depends on the person. Sometimes people just like want to sit down in front of the TV, eat their meal, or like watch a YouTube video while you're eating. I would say if you are going into a meal soup starving, you're at that extreme hunger, again, sometimes it's going to happen. That's when I would say the eliminating distractions piece you really want to hone in on, because you're not going to be able to stop yourself. You're just going to be wolfing down food. Yep. And if you're watching something, like, it's going to be really difficult. But this is like, I don't want to tell a person if they really enjoy like watching their YouTube video.
I was going to say, there has not been a dinner in the last year of my life where I have not been watching Good Mythical Morning on YouTube.
Yeah.
My favorite dinner console.
I've given this example before for me of something that happened to me like a few months ago, but an example of this would be like, for me one time, it was later at night, and like, I kind of just wanted something to do. I knew I was not that hungry, but I'm like, I kind of want some pistachios because they're there.
Yeah.
So I ate pistachios while I was reading my book. Right. And so this was like a snack that is very easy to eat mindlessly, very easy to overconsume. A good example would also be a bag of chips. But for me, I ate those pistachios and like, all of a sudden I looked up from my book and I was like, I'm going to be sick. holy shit, I ate this whole, I feel like I'm actually going to be sick. Why did I eat all those? Because I was distracted. So like, that's a good example of like, not when you're sitting down to eat a well-balanced meal, like that's a little bit, that's more intentional. But if you're just snacking and things that are really easy to overeat, like that's where I would say, try and be present. Like
really, I'm thinking it's more for people who are in that first tip of the day of trying to pay more attention to your hunger cues. If you're not used to paying attention to hunger and fullness cues at all, start by just eliminating your distractions. If I struggle with that, I would turn off Retin-Link in a heartbeat. They're on GMM. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd turn it off because you can't pay attention to those things if you're distracted, if you're on Instagram. I mean, I'll go through times where I'm on TikTok and I have the TV going on and there's something else going on while I'm eating at the same time, which is okay because I have a pretty good understanding of my hunger and fullness cues. But if I didn't and I was trying to learn, fat chance I would learn how to do that.
It is so, I found it so crazy. So I've been living with my boyfriend now for two years. And we sit down to eat together. Like I would say like 4 to 5 nights a week, we sit down to eat dinner together versus for so long. I mean, I grew up in a household before I went to college where we would sit down as a family to eat. But in college, grad school, even after I graduated, I'm sitting down, I'm eating alone. So it's been the first time where I've just had company and it's really just me and another person. I never clear my plate anymore, ever. Because sometimes there'll just be periods of silence, but I'm not, it's so crazy how big of a change it has made in terms of how much I'm eating at dinner time, where that used to be a meal where I would feel the most full after and the most uncomfortable. And that never happens to me anymore, unless if I go out to dinner or something. But it's crazy. I just had to put that in there. But something you could do like to help eat more mindfully is ask yourself some questions, either like, you just ask them to yourself now while you're eating, after you eat, but just ask yourself, like, do I actually enjoy what I'm eating? Am I only eating because it's available or because I really want it? Does it satisfy a craving I'm having or is it satisfying my hunger or is it doing both? Has this food solved any problem like I may have thought it would? So these are going to apply, like I'm not saying ask yourself all of these, but in certain situations. So say like with binge eating, a lot of people binge eat, they think it's going to relieve certain emotional distress you have. Did it solve that problem? Or maybe the problem was that you needed to get your protein in. Did it solve that? Was that the problem and you needed to solve it? It could be anything.
Like what's the purpose of the meal?
Yeah. How is your food changing your appetite? Do you notice your hunger going away? How do you emotionally feel after eating it? And then like, were you actually hungry? And if not, why did I decide to eat? So these are just some questions that you can ask yourself. And asking those, that is, in doing that, you're being mindful while you eat. Doesn't matter the answer to it. You're there. You're present. So over time, these observations can help you identify the reasons for your food choices and make the appropriate changes for your eating habits. So, yeah.
I like to almost think of it as it honestly can be an extension of meditation, which I used to in my early teens think meditation was the most woo-woo foo-foo out there joke that I've ever heard of, like just sitting there and just not think. I used to be like, oh, it's just sitting there and not thinking. And it's not really what meditation is at all until I started thinking of it as more of a form of mental training. And this is kind of a form of meditation for food.
Yeah.
Where there's this thing called neuroplasticity that most people have heard of. Right? The brain's ability to reorganize itself, forming new neural connections and patterns. Most people have heard of that. And we used to think that was only a thing that happened when we were young, when we were kids. And now we realize that that happens through our entire lives, which was one of the coolest, most empowering mindset shifts I went through is realizing that your brain's kind of plastic. So no matter where you are, no matter how shitty your life is or how crappy you think things are, you can physically mold your brain to be different. That's what got me through a lot of my early 20s depression is realizing like, okay, this sucks now, but I can go through these practices. I can change how my brain functions.
Yeah.
You can change how your brain goes through the day. You can change those patterns. But sometimes those patterns run really, really deep. A good analogy, I think I've only brought up once on this podcast before that's really helpful, is to think of those mental patterns kind of like a ski slope, where they have to comb the ski slopes at the end of every day. They have to go down and comb it or else moguls are formed, right? Those little bumps that are just naturally there as skiers push snow into mounds as they turn. But they form these deep trenches or paths the more and more people go down the slope, without it being combed until eventually they just get so deep where it's a molehill. You can't do anything outside of those predetermined paths. You can't just go straight down. You can't create your own path. You have to go down this path. That's kind of like these patterns that are formed deep in our heads over years and years of eating or doing these things, most of them subconscious that we aren't even recognizing are there, are these deeply formed patterns. And if you think of this a lot like mental patterns is where I was going, is just, it's almost impossible to get out of them if they get too deep. But meditation has a massive influence on neuroplasticity that people don't realize. A massive influence. And not just in this food setting, but meditation practice. I've been doing daily meditation for the better part of the last like 8 years of my life. And it's one of the things I swear the most by. But long-term meditation has been studied a lot to physically change your brain, with MRI scans showing higher density of gray matter in several areas of the brain associated with higher order brain functions like awareness, concentration, decision-making. So almost think of meditation or this mindful eating, as silly or cheesy as it might sound, it's like laying a fresh layer of snow on top of those deep cut moguls or patterns that are there. And eventually, if you keep laying fresh snow on top, you get to choose wherever you want to go. You get to form whatever new connections you want. You don't have to go down that predetermined path.
Yeah.
So meditation in this form is so powerful.
And it's going to be, this is going to be the most productive way, honestly, the most productive way to target those learned behaviors over the course of your life and kind of pick up on them. These behaviors that maybe you didn't realize you were even doing or didn't even realize that you had. And again, pick up these patterns on why you are behaving the way you are behaving around food. If you are doing this consistency is the biggest piece for this. This is not going to happen overnight. Improving your relationship with food, again, it depends on where you're at, but like this takes time. Like for me, it really took 2 solid years of consistency day in, day out, every single day. There was no time off from it. It was something I really, again, I'm talking from an extreme level. But that's where it has the most power of just like anything, being consistent. And that's where you see the most payoff. But from here, it's like, this will give you those aha moments of like, oh my God, I always binge on at this time of night during the weekdays because X, Y, and Z. The same thing happens every single time. You will have those really powerful aha moments that allow you to productively adjust your behavior, because so many times, or just when you're trying to have a better relationship with food or trying to make any real nutrition decision, you're reaching for things based off of what so many other outside influences have told you to do or told you is going to work. The most infuriating thing, I think, especially with overeating, I find with people who really struggle with overeating, is having so many people say, this worked for me. This making it look so simple, or this, because it is a learned behavior that has so much behind it. Like that nobody has the same exact experience, but you have to make your own connections. You have to connect the dots based off of your own life. And that always infuriates me is when people like really, really oversimplify it, when it's like, you don't know my eating patterns. You don't know what I'm doing during the day.
Which honestly is probably one of the main reasons why it's not, people aren't successful with it, is because it takes so freaking long. Just relating it back to the meditation practice, it took me probably a good 6 months to a year until I could really start noticing massive difference. And it was doing that daily. Mm-hmm. I used to have the Headspace app and just do it every once in a while, once or twice a week, and I would never see meaningful steps forward. Mm-hmm. Where if you start doing it every single day, I mean, by day 6 or 7, you at least start to see movement forward.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just noticing thoughts. It's such a powerful tool. So number 4, one down the list, ditch the trendy diets in the food rules. Ditch them. Mm-hmm. Throw them out the window. And really, when we're talking about trendy diets, we're talking about really any diet with a name or an end date to it. I'm on keto, I'm doing keto, or I'm doing carnivore, or I'm doing plant-based for now, or I'm doing whatever. Plant-based, if you're doing it for ethical reasons, that's phenomenal. But if you're using it as a dieting tool, the hard 90-day hard, I forget the name of it by now.
75 hard. It has an
75 hard, 90-day. Yeah, 75 hard, something with an expiration date. I didn't realize this crossover until recently, But I've noticed an insane change in my relationship to work over the past few years of working for myself. I'm wondering if you've kind of noticed it too, where we both work for ourselves and we do something that we're also really passionate about, which I think is cool and lucky and a position that not a lot of people get to be in or should be in a lot of the time. Not for everybody. But in doing that and in working constantly in things that I want to be working on, is I get asked a lot about this question of work-life balance as if they're two separate things. And I felt really confused answering this question for so long until recently I started kind of having the realization that in this particular scenario, they're not two different things. Like my work and my life, they kind of are intertwined where it's not like I clock in at this time, I clock in at this time, I'm either work Tony or I'm off of work Tony. Mm-hmm. They're very intertwined. So there's not really a balancing act you have to play because they're not two separate things. And I think if you think about this, like dieting, that's how people usually see it with these trendy diets is either you're dieting or you're off, or you're dieting or you're taking a break from your diet or you're breaking your diet. That's it. You're either doing one or the other and you have to balance it. How much time am I spending dieting versus how much time am I spending not? How much time am I giving to cheat meals versus how much time am I doing this? If you start to see your diet and food as this just one constant thing with no goods, no bads, but just this constant thing in life, I think that eliminates a lot of the sticking points people have with it, right? Yeah. I've never thought about it like that before, but when it just kind of came to me, I'm like, this is how I used to think about work and life. I'm like, oh, if I work over X amount of hours, I'm burnt out because of my previous job. If I worked more than 55 hours, I was burnt out, but that was also not doing something that was intertwined with my life. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you felt that. Like, it's weird being on social media and doing posts because posting on social media is a large part of our job. Like, it is a physical part of our job. And a lot of people don't realize that. I know Karina had a hard time realizing that at first too, is if I had to give time to social media, it's like, hey, this, I know it just seems like social media, but this is a part of my job. Like, it's a job requirement. Companies do it, but that's thought of as the company doing it or marketing. When you are the social media, it's a little bit different because it's a weird little balance there too. But that's at least how I see this whole thing with if you're on these trendy diets or diets with rules, is that sets you up to either be succeeding at a diet or breaking your diet. And those are the only two things that you could be doing.
Yeah.
Instead of just going through life as one.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. When you're hopping off on diets, you're just constantly putting yourself in a position to fail. You are constantly putting yourself in position to fail versus I look at my dietary approach and how I try to get people to approach diet is there's never a time where I'm failing at how I'm eating. There's never a time where I'm going to really get down on myself or it's going to define me in such a way that I'm either succeeding in my overall health and fitness or not. No, it's, oh, sometimes I need to improve. Like, oh,
yeah.
This past month, I haven't been eating many vegetables. Okay, I'm going to eat a few. I'm going to just focus on that a little bit more right now. You know, it's not this, oh my goodness, I have to make this drastic change. With our diet, always going to be room for improvement sometimes. But if you're constantly grasping for something that is so black and white, telling you exactly how you should be eating all of the time, it's going to be impossible to do any of these other things. One, to have a good relationship with food. And it is never going to be sustainable. It is never, never, never. I don't care if you could adhere to it for 3 years. There is going to be an expiration on it because you cannot, your body, your brain will not allow you to be that restrictive and that ignore your cues for that long. You just can't. So you're just always setting yourself up for failure.
Absolutely. It goes through, it breaks all of the previous tips that we broke down as if you're following one of these trendy diets 99% of the time. These diets are labeling a food as good or bad, where you eat the good and you don't eat the bad. That's 99% of trendy diets. Keto, carbs are bad, don't eat carbs. Carnivore, whatever there that keeps changing based on whatever he wants to change it as. Right, whatever the diet is, it has rules in these sense. And it, one, doesn't make sense logically from a health perspective, but two, you got to realize that. Mm-hmm. It's going to make it so you're playing a game with your food through the rest of your life instead of it just being a part of your life, where you understand. And there's different seasons for this as well, too.
Yeah,
if you're going through, and for whatever reasons, you don't have to be going through competition prep or something hardcore where it requires you to be a little bit more tuned in and tied down and restrictive. That's fine. We're not saying don't do those things.
Yeah.
Or same thing, if I want to go through a cutting phase, I usually tighten things up pretty quick because I don't like to spend a lot of time cutting. So I'll try and go a little bit more rapid. So I don't have to spend 6 months losing body fat. I'd rather spend 2 months and just suffer a little bit from the lifestyle.
But you also have a good relationship with food. So you can do that.
Very
true. You
know
what I mean?
Yeah, because that's how I feel like people see it, though, is if they don't have a good relationship with food, they're like, well, aren't you doing that thing? It's like, it's how you approach it. It's the intention behind it. Mm-hmm. Me knowing I'm going to be a little bit more stricter for 2 months, knowing that it's to get me closer to my goal and then I can return right back to normal soon after. I have an exit strategy from that diet approach. It'll get me exactly where I want to go. It has an intention. I'm not doing it to try and figure out a problem that I can't solve yet. I'm not doing it to punish myself. I'm not doing it for any other reason. I'm doing it because it logically fits. There's seasons like that all the way in life. And once, I think you're right, you get to a healthy relationship with food, you start to understand that better.
Yeah.
But yeah. Until then, it does seem like it's almost one and the same.
Oh, for sure. For sure. This is where it's like, I'm not talking about being in a calorie. We're not talking about having more structured physique related goals of like whether you are going to do like a cut or a bulk and having a little bit more rigid schedule and paying attention to your calorie consumption, right? That's not what I'm talking about. For some people, like, again, like this is improving your relationship with food. This is not how to cure an eating disorder. I've mentioned that I have had one, but if you have an eating disorder, like that, we are not advising what someone to do. That is a mental illness. That is something that needs professional help to improve. A lot of these things can help with that, right? But this is not going to cure an eating disorder. So I just want to make that very clear because people always say shit.
But that's a good point to make.
Yeah. With diets, right? They are designed, like these specific diets, they are quite literally designed to put you in this diet cycle of being on track versus off track. That's how the diet industry has so much money in it. It's more disguised in these. It looks like, oh, keto is the best for my health. No, the keto diet is just the modernized version of the Atkins diet. There is so much money in it. You are bombarded, especially for people, adults who start to take more interest in their nutrition and health and improving their relationship with food. All of a sudden, you realize that you've been bombarded for years by bad diets, fear mongering around food, developing this like fear and guilt and anxiety about eating. And it has impacted your perception of what eating normally even is. When was the last time I ate when I wasn't trying to be on some diet? Or I didn't just come off a diet and now I can just eat whatever I want until I'm starting the next diet again. When did I not have these feelings of shame and guilt that propelled me to eat food? That is what over time prolonged trendy fad yo-yo dieting can really do to you. And it's why there is so much money in it, because everyone keeps going back. Because you don't know the solution, you don't know what your normal is, and you feel like, well, the only thing I could do now is to go back on another diet. It is this crazy cycle that you get stuck in. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. And
that's a good point. You got to stop defining if something worked, if a diet worked, if a whatever worked, based on if you initially saw progress. You should base if something works on if you maintained that progress. Mm-hmm. That's where so many people, because they'll go back to these trendy diets like keto. They're like, oh, well, keto worked, is what they'll tell themselves for 30 days. It's the only thing I've seen work, but it didn't work because after 30 days, you fell off of it. You gained back everything you lost. That's not working.
Yeah.
So every time they'll fall off and they blame the diet for the success, but they don't blame the diet for the fall off. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, it did both of those things. It did give you early success, but because of that, it also caused you to fall off and why you couldn't redo it.
Yeah.
That's the perfect point. It's a billion-dollar industry because it counts on you coming back and back over and over again.
Yeah. These all, like the quick fix diets, like they also propel your food issues and just make them spiral even more because they can lead to that black and white thinking about food, whether or not like food is good or bad. They have ingrained in you these thought patterns that aren't sustainable. They give you this mindset that if you are not losing weight, right? Weight loss is the only reason why this diet is good. That is,
you're not losing 5 pounds a week.
Yeah. And not doing it quickly, then you're failing, right? So like, instead of putting yourself, I always have called it like the diet bubble. putting yourself in this diet bubble, there's so much more productive things you could do. How much energy did it just sound like that would take to be in that constant cycle? It takes so much energy. It is so consuming. So take that energy, right? And focus on making changes that you can realistically make to your day that you could do every day. Like, oh yeah, I know I could add like some high fiber veggies to my lunch and dinners for sure. I could do that 5 days of the week. I could start cooking more meals at home, giving yourself a number of meals to cook at home, letting your hunger guide what you're eating, prioritize foods that make you feel good. I need to increase my protein and fiber intake, right? Get more specific about actual productive changes to your diet, giving a time, not a time frame, but getting a specific time. So like I'm going to do 5 lunches during the week. So get specific to it. And I feel like I could do this forever. That may sound crazy. Yeah. Forever may sound crazy, but that's how you're building a habit that this is just how I'm eating. This is, this has no expiration date because it's something I want to be doing for the long term.
Five ever. Speaking of five ever, forever.
Five.
What's number five?
I feel like I started talking about five on accident and forgot that this was one, but.
Yeah, these are all intertwined with each other, but number five to wrap up the day is what?
Yeah, stop letting other people's opinions and actions influence your food choices. So let me be very clear, as a food nutrition influencer, right? This is not getting, I'm not talking about getting advice, getting in informative information, like seeking out help, seeking out extra information. Like you guys are listening to this right now to learn more about how, like we are in a way you could say that is influencing your thought pattern, right? But this is more so along the lines of only letting other people tell you what to do. You have to take into account your life. You have to take into account your individual health, what your environment is like, what's realistic for you. You have to put yourself first and be realistic first, and then you can be informed. It's like anything. You should not take what anyone says as scripture when you're trying to improve an aspect of your life. It could be if I'm trying to improve my financial literacy. If I only take certain people's viewpoints or only listen to this one person and think that this is just automatically going to work for me, that's not realistic. I'm not going to be successful because that's just not how it works, right? You've got to take yourself into account first, and you cannot, I would never want Tony and I to be these people that you only listen to, that you just take and you're like, okay, what they say goes. We would never want that. So I just need to clarify that. I just realized that now that this could come across as kind of hypocritical.
No, not at all. Not at all. I think it's more of when you're comparing what other people are doing specifically to what you're doing specifically. As in you see a female bodybuilding competitor and she shows her calories and macros and you're like, oh, well, she's losing fat really fast. I'm going to do those calories and macros.
Yes.
It's why I have a mixed review. I get asked to do what I eat in a day videos all the time because they can be great for learning new meal ideas and how to structure your day. They can do so many good things, but on the other end, I don't make the videos just because I don't want to take the effort to film through my whole day because I'm
lazy. Oh my God, whenever I do them, but which is rare, they do so well, but I hate them.
I'm more lazy. But a lot of people take them as, oh, I should do exactly what that person's doing.
Yeah.
And what we've covered this whole day is realizing you're a little bit different, not just physiologically and just your body composition, but mentally, where you're at, what you can handle. Like one of my favorite, her name is Valentina Rodriguez. She works actually she's one of Bill Campbell's students, Bill Campbell. Ooh. And she is 4'11 and she's going into a competition and people ask her all the time, like what her calories and macros are. And she just doesn't tell people because I don't want to give anyone the wrong idea. I'm a small person dieting for a show. I'm doing things that are more restrictive. And that's totally fine to do over time, depending on your goal, right? If you want to compete at that level, you got to do more challenging, restrictive things. It's the intention behind it. But a lot of people will see, I think, other people who share what they do and say, this is what eat this breakfast that I eat and you'll lose fat like I did. There's a lot of people who share stuff like that. And that's what we're saying more stay away from, because a lot of people, and she does a great job of this, a lot of competitors are coming out doing a realistic job, is before they would show what the outcome was, i.e. their physique, what their aesthetic looked like on stage. Oh my God, ripped six pack, insane, right? And this is talking before PED use, but just genetics and hardcore dieting and training for 10 years, what that physically looks like. And they won't show all the negative things that can sometimes come with that. I love when people are opening up about it. They're like, hey, I stepped on stage. I looked like this. I looked fucking dope. But I also had zero freaking energy. I was exhausted 24/7. I also couldn't sleep at night. I had no sex drive. I felt like shit throughout the entire day. I was obsessing over the thought of food. I love when people come out and say that, because a lot of the time those extreme results take these extreme negative drawbacks.
Yeah.
And that's okay if your goal requires that. If you want that goal for the right reason, because you want to compete, because you want to prove something to yourself, because you want to see what your body's capable of, that's awesome. But just know what you're choosing. You're not just choosing the body, you're choosing everything that comes with that.
Yeah.
And that's a totally fine choice to make. But just make sure that you're making that choice. You're not just chasing something that looks cool while ignoring everything that comes with it.
Ruining your life to do it. Like,
yeah, while ignoring what else could come with that. It's like there's pros and cons to everything.
Yeah.
That's not one of them. So that's what I think a lot of it is just take everything into account.
At the end of the day, your own specific needs and nutrition requirements are never going to be the same as some influencer on the internet who knows nothing about your health. What works for someone may not work for you. And the few what I eat in a day videos I've posted, so many people are like, well, how many calories are in, like, we're in this? What are your macros? So many people ask me, first of all, like, I'm not tracking, but even if I was, I'm like, how many other women are 6 feet tall and like genetically I've always been leaner? Like that.
True.
How is that going to what if that 4'11" girl you're just talking about tried to eat like me? She would probably gain a lot of weight because she's 4'11" and I'm 6 feet tall.
Absolutely.
And my BMR is really fucking high. So it's just, you know what I mean? So it's just would never be productive for me to say that. But also, I think another piece to this too is just the not letting, like, you need to stop letting other people's opinions like really influence your decisions, but also stop comparing what you eat to others. If you're making a decision, a sound nutrition decision for you, and someone else does the exact opposite, and this someone else is someone you wish you looked like, do not let that change this decision that you made confidently, that you've been working towards confidently. I'm going to say an extreme example. If you've been trying to eat more green vegetables and all of a sudden fucking Carnivore MD comes on here and says that broccoli is bullshit and gives you cancer, so you stop eating vegetables. You have made such a sound and realistic nutrition decision confidently on your own, and you're going to let someone else come in and take that away from you. It's almost like bullshit. Absolutely
you
not.
You don't let someone come up at your house and tell you what to do.
Right?
You were going a little...
So that's an extreme example, but I feel like looking at it from that perspective can be helpful, especially if you're struggling with self-confidence and that comparison piece. Just taking a step back before you're like, oh, I can't do this anymore, and just reframing it like, I made this decision. And but literally 5 minutes ago before I saw this, I was confident in this decision and had reason behind it. And it's for me, like reminding yourself that. So
yeah, you can let them lead you to deepen your thought process on why you're doing something. But one person saying one thing shouldn't just completely change what you're doing.
Yeah.
Something that we utter if you're doing something and we say, don't do X, Y, or Z, which I think we do a pretty good job of not saying.
Not doing.
You shouldn't just change it without question. That might be like, okay, I might look into this a little bit more and then change and update my opinion based on that. Yeah. That's all it's really saying. I always like these episodes, the relationship.
Me too.
Because I feel like we try and put a little bit more structure to something that is very disorganized and hard to put structure on. So I that's what we try and do. I know it still kind of might seem messy sometimes, but
yeah. And this is also personal. Important. Like your relationship with food is personal. And so I just feel like more people, like with platforms like us talking about this, is going to be really helpful, because sometimes people, you might not want to reach out to anyone and ask for help because these feelings are not ones that you're ready to voice yet, or feel like there is an aspect of shame. There is an aspect of guilt. There is an aspect of why is this happening to me type of thing. So I just feel like it's nice to like one, especially how we're talking about this. It is so common. It is so common. If you're in a room with 10 people, I'm sure I say with confidence, at least one of those people you would be able to relate to on having a shitty relationship with food.
Oh, yeah.
Like it is just so normal, and take it one step at a time. Focus on what is the most impactful in your life, you notice the most often and causes the most distress, and approach that first and then go on from there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
These are the important ones. I never think they're going to be as fun as they are. And then we go through it. I'm like, dang, that was one of the more fun episodes we've done in a while.
Yeah.
I like it. everyone over on Premium. We'll talk to y'all this Friday doing our weekly AMA, supplement giveaways, everything else. So we'll talk to you guys on Friday. Everybody else, we will see you back here on Monday with a fresh new episode.